Here we go. This is episode 538. My name's Alex Pardo. You're listening to the Flip Empire Show. And today's masterclass, I got my friend Fuquan Bilal, and he's got a really, really interesting, fascinating story. On this podcast, we talk about a lot of the adversity that he had to overcome, from how the environment that he was raised in to the market crashing in 2008. We talk about a conversation that he had with his then 8-year-old son, and his son was the one that challenged him and asked him why not. As a result of that question, he launched his own fund, which is a company, a very successful company he still has today. And really, the focus of today's episode is about a lot of the adversity he had to overcome and how that might translate to you as an entrepreneur, what you can draw from Fuquan's experience. And then we talk a lot about raising private capital. So whether you're interested in starting a fund or just doing one-off, working with private lenders one-off, what does that conversation look like? What are some of the pitfalls and the mistakes that a lot of real estate entrepreneurs and investors make when it comes to raising private capital? And he shares some jewels and some gems that you probably haven't heard on other podcasts, and things that can really make a difference for you in your business when it comes to raising private capital, when it comes to building relationships, contributing versus extracting. So this show is jam-packed with a lot of valuable content that can really propel you in your real estate business and in your journey as an entrepreneur. So without further ado, let's hop into episode 538 with Fuquan Bilal.
You're listening to Flip Empire, the show committed to helping real estate entrepreneurs who want to build their empire without sacrificing their life. Your success and freedom starts now with your host, Alex Pardo.
Welcome back, my friends. Alex Pardo here. Always, always super grateful to be able to host this show, because I have the opportunity selfishly to connect with just high achievers, high level thinkers. And today is no different. I got my buddy Fuquan Bilal on the podcast. And Fuquan is somebody who I had the opportunity to meet at a mastermind that he and I were a part of probably about a year and a half ago at this point, Fuquan, when you and I met. And somebody that just carries himself with a lot of positivity and energy. And we're connected on social media. I love everything you're doing in the business world. And just, again, the positive vibes that you put out, man, you're a wealth of knowledge. And it's a long time coming, so I'm excited to have you on the show.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. It was actually March of 2019.
There you go.
When we met. Yeah, so it's been 3 years, actually.
It's 3 years. Incredible how time flies, man. Yeah. So, but yeah, dude, I love everything you're putting out there. Just for those listening that maybe have not connected with you or don't know much about you, why don't we spend a couple of minutes just kind of giving people a little bit of just a background? I covered some of it in the intro, but talk about a little bit how you got into the business, and then we can fast forward to what your business looks like today. And then really the heart of today's podcast episode is going to be about raising private capital.
Yeah, sure.
You're an expert in that, and you have a lot of knowledge to share with people. So I'm excited to dive into that.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I watch all your content, and it's always value that people you bring on and the message that you put out. So I appreciate it. About me, I'm a superhero to my kids, first and foremost. You know, I started real estate in 2019, jumped out the window, grew wings, and I did a lot of flips, and I didn't have any rentals, didn't do anything related to that. Before that, I've always been in sales. From as far as back, I remember, from 10 years old, my mom used to take us out to the flea market, and we had things we used to sell from Chinatown. We used to buy a wholesale and sell the gloves, scarves, and hats retail. And that kind of gave me a thirst of entrepreneurship. And I love sales. So I did that in my career in corporate, and sort of writing on the wall in 2019 that really the value that I was adding to these corporations, I can pretty much do my own thing. I gravitated towards real estate. And since 2009, actually, not 2019, 2009, started in the real estate business. It's been a 21-year journey. I have the war scars to prove it. It's been a battle, been through 9/11, 2007, 2008, and rebounded back from that. And my focus after the market crash was really to become a master of money instead of a slave to it. Because before that, you know, I was chasing money. Wasn't spending time with my family, wasn't being a father that I should have been, just missing out on the whole family part, which once you get to a certain level, you realize that's really what it's all about, creating memories. I see you travel with your family, and I'm pretty sure that was so valuable in creating those memorable moments. So that's really what I focus on today. But as far as business, I'm a fund manager for Energy Capital Fund, which is a fund I created in 2013. And that all happened because when the market crashed, I started to do short sales like everyone else. Mm-hmm. And my son at the time, he was 8 years old, and he'll be 19 this year though. He was 8 years old and he heard me on the phone. I had just picked him up from school. He heard me on the phone with a short sale negotiator going back and forth, frustrated. And when I got out the car, he was like, what was that about? And I said, well, these banks really don't want to help anybody. And he was like, why don't you become the bank? And I was wow. like, become the bank? That's impossible. He's like, Dad, I just said anything was possible. So I was like, oh, wow. All right. So I started to investigate, become the bank, and figured out I needed to set up a fund. And to me, that was like way above my pay grade. I always looked at Wall Street fund managers as something that I would never be able to achieve from where I come from. And I just started to investigate, hired an SEC attorney. It wound up costing me almost $30,000 to set up my first fund. And when I look back at it now, that was the best thing I ever did, because it gives you the opportunity to actually help people earn interest on their money and also utilize that capital to go and do impact projects, what I call. So I come from North New Jersey, pretty rough area, grew up in the 80s, crack and everything was prevalent during that time. So mm-hmm. the only choices you had was, what do they say, jump shot or crack rock. So we grew up in an Islamic community. So our mom sheltered us from a lot of that. And basically, for me to go back to the community to make a difference, revitalize those properties, gave him, I feel that I'm important. So that's pretty much what we do with the capital we raise. We go into the low-income areas, revitalize those. In New Jersey, where I've been investing for the last 21 years. And we also do some high-end flips also in better areas, A-plus class areas, where we do million-dollar properties that we sell as well. So we go from the affordable home market to the luxury market, wherever we can find the best profitable deal.
Got it. Man, Fuquan, I want to kind of hit the pause button here because there's so much.
Yeah, I just go like.
No, that right. Dude, that's good. I'm glad you covered all that, because I learned some things about you that I didn't even know myself. But there's so much to unpack. And there's a couple things that jump out at me. Number one, I'm fascinated by the fact that your son, who I think you said was 8 at the time, your business, NNG Capital Fund, was born, it sounds like, out of your son asking you a question, why can't you be the bank, and challenging your own limiting beliefs about that. You use the words, I'm somebody who's very in tune with the language that people use. And you said like, that was above my pay grade at the time. And I was like, how do I even do this? So I'm fascinated by the fact that you now have a successful business that was born out of your 8-year-old son challenging you.
Correct.
So talk a little bit about that, because obviously you've done a lot of good as a father. If even your son was thinking like, hey, nothing's challenging you, like, hey, nothing's impossible, why can't you be the bank? So talk a little bit about that, because I think that's a really cool story.
Yeah. So since my son was 3 years old, when I had him, again, I was chasing money. I wasn't really a master of it. So until he started walking, I really was just like, all right, so mom, you take care of him. When he walked, then it's my turn. So when he started walking, I started to really take him around with me more. But when he turned 3, he really was his shotgun. I was doing projects in Philly. It was a whole bunch of stuff I was doing in PA. You literally can get properties back then. You're talking, I don't know, 2005, something like that, for $5,000. So I was buying blocks of stuff in Philly, South Philly, where now it's probably $500,000 stuff. But anyway, he was traveling with me there. So he was always around me with contractors, always around me at construction sites and everything else. So he began to understand at an early age what the real estate market consisted of, because I would take him with me all the time to give his mom a break. And we had started a new business during that time as well. So he learned the lingo and kind of understood the business. So by the time he was 8 years old, he understand the concept. He knew when the market crashed, he saw a transition of how we were living to, I went through a divorce. So he was pretty much involved in all that. So he was able to see, hear me on the phone constantly with the negotiators, taking him to school and had the phone on speaker, talking to negotiators, trying to do short sales while I'm dropping them off at school. And yeah, he just asked me that question. I actually wrote about it in my first book, Turning Distress into Success. You guys can get that on Amazon. That's me sharing my knowledge about the note business, because I learned that business actually while doing short sales, just to pivot to that a bit. Negotiator had asked me, why don't you just buy the note? And I was like, what is that? He's like, yeah, we'll assign all of the assignment of mortgage and the note over to you. We'll endorse it over to you and you can take ownership and you can continue the foreclosure if you wish or work something out with the homeowner. So that got me really thinking about this other part of the business that I had no idea was happening. So at the time, I got the idea of becoming your own bank and from the short sale negotiator on buying paper.
Yeah.
So I started to investigate both of those at the same time. And lo and behold, in 2013, fast forward from 2010, I was able to create a note fund, which was my first fund, and set up my own private banking, so to speak, to go buy and do deals on a large scale.
Yeah. Incredible, man. So I'm fascinated by your story on so many different levels. I love the fact that you talk about how early on you were chasing money and maybe your focus wasn't on what ultimately really matters. And you had, what was the pivot or mindset shift for you there? Was it the crash that said, hey, I need to kind of approach things a little bit different here? I'm curious, what was the trigger for you to start to kind of go down a different path as far as how you approached business and earning wealth while still being the father and just being family man and all that?
Yeah, for me, I think it was real estate really carried a lot of this stuff. At the time, I was all over the place. I was spread too thin. I had four different businesses. If I can remember, I had a car wash. I had a 25 van transportation company to do transportation for disabled children. I had a hair salon, a 25 chair hair salon where I was renting the chairs on a weekly basis.
You're kidding.
And yeah, all at the same time. And I was doing real estate. So we had like 54 employees in all. And every time me and my former wife went out to dinner, it would be business. So we kind of grew apart because of all the businesses and everything. Then a market crash, boom. And the real estate funded all of those businesses until they were able to stand on their feet. The car wash was fairly new. The salon I had already had running. That was like easy money. Transportation company was the most profitable business off the ground. And I was still doing flips, making money from that. But it was no rental income. So in a market crash, and I had like 30-something properties, and no banks were funding. A lot of them were in different phases of construction. I had private money back then, but it wasn't a fund. It was, hey, loan me money and I'll put up to 20% to close and the construction money. I just need you to loan me 80% of the purchase price. So I had private investors doing that. So I had skin in the game as well. When the market closed, I had a couple million dollars of my money tied up into these projects, these 30 different projects. And it was just major. But you can't have closings. Things are falling apart. Relationships I had with brokers overnight, they shut down. And it was just a ripple effect. So me dealing with that reality and then knowing that this real estate business was feeding other businesses, you know, it kind of put a strain on my business maybe 6 months later. And basically, I started going through marital issues because of finances and everything else. And I had to make some tough decisions and ultimately ended up with divorce and basically me liquidating all of the properties to make my investors whole. Thank God I didn't have to file bankruptcy. I lost a couple million dollars of my money that I had tied in because I had to fire sell everything. The market went down so low.
Yeah.
It was just crazy. So it took me a year and a half, 2 years to get out of that and to resurface. And during that transition, I actually was blessed to get custody of my boys because I didn't want another man to pass any values or raise their my boys with a different religion or whatever it was that they were going to do, because my former wife had found someone else back then, a regular 9-to-5 person who wasn't trying to conquer the world, less stress. So I was happy for them and I just wanted to custody of my boys, which really made me go closer to them and be the father who I am today and maybe more of a man, a better businessman, everything else, understand it. Because raising capital and running a fund is just like raising kids. So you can imagine all the challenges, the goods, the bads, and the uglies that go along with raising your kids is the same thing as a fund manager. That's how quirky those two. So yeah, I think it was definitely the market that was the shift. And then I really, during that time, I really started doing more inner growth, right? Started to read more. I wasn't a part of any RIAs or anything. I was a millionaire when I was 28 years old. So to me, at the time, I thought I was God. Like, no, nobody can tell me anything. Mm-hmm. I had all the cars, traveled to Europe, all of the stupid materialistic stuff, and ego really big. And the market really, really made me put my ego in my back pocket and sit on it and really start to do more inner work with myself and meditation, created some daily rituals that I still do today. And I think that's what helped me grow. Your business and the things you do will only grow to the extent that you do.
Man, 100, Fuquan. And I always say your outer world is a reflection of your inner world. And I didn't make that up. I forgot where I got that from, but it just always resonated with me. And I think that's a different way to say what you just said. And I think one of the things that really intrigues me, dude, about you and your story is you just outlined, first of all, mad respect. And I really appreciate you being just super transparent about the fact of divorce and losing a couple million dollars and having to liquidate these different businesses. I really want to acknowledge you for, number one, just making that information available to us, because you and I were talking about this before the podcast. I think we both are cut from the same cloth in that we learn so much more from other people's life lessons right? And those things don't define you, but they help shape you. And what I'm hearing is that that was a big blessing in disguise for you, because you started to focus on yourself and you started to do some of that inner work. When you think back to that period of your life running four different businesses, and obviously everything that you outlined as far as your relationship with your former wife and all that, what was the biggest takeaway for you that people can really like just draw from and say, hey, listen, if you might be going down this path where you're chasing material things and you're just chasing the money and you're neglecting some of these other areas of your life, what would you say is the biggest lesson learned when you reflect back on that period of your life that people can really draw from?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an experience everyone has to go through. So I told you where I come from, and basically being raised in a hood, so to speak, the material things, everybody gravitate because they look at that as success. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even I came up through the corporate world, was still, I got to get the best car. I have to have the best clothes and everything else, because that's what I was, the environment that I was raised in. So the point I'm trying to make is the people that you hang around will shape and mold who you become. So the biggest lesson I learned from that was to change my environment. When I started to look around and see the people that was in my circle, it was all toxic. It wasn't anybody who wanted me to win. It was people who wanted to constantly crabs in a barrel, keep me down to their level. So I had to change my circle. At the time, oh, back to what you were saying, your in is your out. I believe that was T. Harvey Eker who said that. So me, it was something else I read in that book. I think it was Feelings, Thoughts, Action, Results, something like that. And I read in that book also that he wrote, I can't remember the book. I think it was Secrets of the Millionaire Mind.
Yeah.
He was talking about, and he gave an example of, look at the people in your environment, and it's like the toxic people are on the other side of a rope, and you're a tug of war, and you got one side and the other four people on the other side, they're going to always pull you towards them. And I had to realize that and change my circle. And then I started to join RIAs. I started to be more just around high level real estate people. And that was really what helped me grow. So a mixture of my daily rituals, getting up, doing my meditation, yoga, writing my goals, journaling, reading for 15 minutes, and doing that day after day after day, and hanging around the right people, really started to shift my mindset. So I definitely would say, you got to get around the right people. A lot of people on goals and dreams and aspirations, you're going to have the people who you may be around now may not believe in that because they can't see that far. So if you do have that vision, try to get around other like-minded people to help bring that vision to a reality.
Yeah. And that's one of the benefits of masterminds. Obviously, you and I invest into ourselves by being a part of high level masterminds. And just by the power of association, you start to think different. You start to think bigger. You know, like attracts like. And that's how you start to change. I love the fact that you say, hey, one of my biggest lessons was you got to change your environment. And one of the cool things that I see from this side of the microphone is that your son is now witnessing that. He sees his dad leveling up by changing his environment. And then whether you know it or not, and I know you do, you're having a profound impact on his life. I think you said now he's 18 years old. And those are things that he was around real estate early on. And now he sees his dad where he was and where he is today. And you're not a finished product. None of us are. Like, we continue to grow and learn and invest in ourselves. So again, dude, I just want to acknowledge you for coming through that adversity and becoming a better man, a better entrepreneur, a better father. And I think it's a powerful story. So I appreciate you sharing it.
Yeah, definitely, man. I think for me, I was talking to Jason Medley from CG, and we were talking when COVID hit.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about transition and pivoting and everything else. And we was like, fight better with blood in my mouth was a comment that we were like texting each other, like, is put on the war paint and let's get ready. Because all of us have been through different adversity. And for me, I like when the times get hard because it brings the better out of you. You start to think more. Because when you make money, you get comfortable and some people get complacent. I always like to be like it's day one. So when adversity come and when I just call them growing moments, opportunities to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%, dude, 100%. So I want to kind of transition now, and I'm glad that we set the stage for this podcast with kind of your backstory and some of the challenges, because I think it really helps people understand who you are better as a man and as an entrepreneur. Let's talk about raising capital. Because one of the things I learned early on is you need to dig your well before you're thirsty. And I don't know what your thoughts are. Everybody's kind of got a little bit of a different opinion on what's going to happen with this real estate market on a macro level and then micro and local market. Like, what's going to happen over the course of the next 6 to 24 months with our market? I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. But the concept of digging your well before you're thirsty, when you have access to private capital, this business becomes so much easier.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, obviously you have a fund and so you're an expert at raising capital. So talk about, and I realize I'm kind of throwing a big picture, very generalized question, but we can start to drill down from there.
Yeah, I mean, raising capital is a whole nother business, right? So for those of you who are just getting started or you got a couple of flips or a couple of rentals under your belt, we always ask ourselves the question, how can I do more, right? And of course, people think, okay, I need more money to do more deals, or I need more deals and I have the money. So you really, in this business, to be successful, you need to have three things: the place to buy your inventory, lead gen, you need the capital to buy, and you got to be able to scale efficiently to get better instead of bigger. So once you have those three things in place, it's just constantly tweaking the systems. How can you get better? How can you get better? How can you get better? Going back to raising capital, my first private capital deal was I had leased an office space, and the owner of the office space, basically, he had in the 2000 boom, the dot-com boom, he cashed out his chips. He was very well off. He went and bought a commercial building, which I rented an office in, and he noticed the movement that was happening, contractors and everything else. We sat down, we had lunch one day. He said, hey, I want to do business with you. So he became essentially my first private lender to my real estate deals. And I didn't know at the time he was arbitraging capital, meaning that instead of using his capital, he had good credit. He'll go get a line of credit for a couple hundred thousand, maybe at 4%, and lend it to me back then at 10%. Yeah. Right. And he was giving me small increments, 50,000, 25,000, 100,000, stuff like that. And we did our first couple of deals that way. Then I tapped into some hard money, and then I would leverage the hard money, combine them both with a blended interest somewhere around 12%. And that was what helped me do a lot of deals. Fast forward, when the market crashed, pay back all my hard money lenders, the few other investors that I had developed on that time. And what I realized is that what the private investors like is transparency and communication.
Yeah.
Right. Of course, you know you're going to pay them on time because they're not going to lend you again if you're ever late with a payment. So for me, the transparency was going out, recording the process. He was local, so he got to meet me at different phases of the construction projects and paying him on the timeline that we set. Usually we set maybe 6 months or 1 year, and constantly executing, building a track record with this one investor, and then utilizing them as a resource that other investors that want to do business with me to contact and ask how is the business, so on and so forth. Then basically, once we did business for over a year, hey, you have other friends who may be interested, you can introduce them and start to build my book of business with private investors that way, by just being transparent, doing what I said I was going to do, paying on time. And also, there's a few other touches that you do, holiday gifts and things like that. You might want to hold quarterly meetings if once you get to a certain level and do presentations to let them know what you're doing with the capital, what your future plans are, maybe some management discussion, analysis, things. And then as you grow, then you can start sending email and everything else. So that's how the ground roots started with private investing. After the market crashed, everybody was scared, so nobody was lending any money. And I really, again, at the time wasn't a part of any RIAs, so I didn't understand what was happening with the economy, anything but what I saw in the news. And when I started to educate myself and get around RIAs, and at that time, you had a lot of private investors and different people who wanted to be active in a business, but they were working and they wanted to do flips. But then after they figure out that they found someone who was already active, who already had the system that they can partner with possibly, then they will pretty much lend you capital. So I started doing joint ventures, 50-50 deals where investors will put up all the capital. And then I would put up, because I had just told you, took a loss. So me coming back in, I was looking for investors that can put up all the capital and utilize my experience. So I did deals like that for a year, and that helped me rebuild after the storm my track record of what I can do. Because before the storm, nobody cares, right? I used to do this and blah, 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 blah. Okay, what are you doing now? And that's all that matters. And that's all that matters. What you did 2 years ago don't matter today, right?
You constantly have to be updating your resume. Yeah.
So by me doing that and building those relationships for a year or two, I was able to rebuild my capital stack and basically start to really negotiate different on deals and really started to find private passive investors who really just wanted a nice return and didn't want any upside. So I started to build a book of business that way. Fast forward to 2011, I started learning the note business, and I still was doing some real estate to feed myself and started to learn a note business, invest in my own capital. And then 2013, I created a fund. The process with the fund was a little different because I had to hire an SEC attorney, right? And basically they had to educate me on the business, right? The risk that the investors have, the liability that I have. And the biggest cost for me was the operating agreement because I had to put my whole business plan together. Who's responsible for what? Who's the executive team? So when people are investing on that level, they want to know, is this not you? Who's your team? What are their roles and responsibility? What is your business killer plan? If something happens to you, who's stepping up? What happens to the assets? So going through all of that was just hours and hours and hours and hours. And back then in 2013, I think he was charging like $250 an hour. Now it's $550 an hour. So, yeah.
How long did that process take you, Fuquan?
Oh, my God. It took us like maybe 3 months to put everything together. And when it was all said and done, I had a private placement memorandum. It's like almost $30,000, if I remember. And I was saying, oh, my God, it was for only $2 million. I would put together a fund for $2 million. And it was a big mistake. And again, that goes with my confidence back then. So first, remember, my son said, open your own bank. How do you do it? I invested, you know, almost $30,000 setting it up. And at the time, my mindset was, all I got to do is get this PPM set up and then people are going to give me money. Right. Mm. So big mistake. You know, I invested money in it. He set it up and he goes, hey, here's the 100-page PPM. And I'm like, okay, the first couple of pages, don't invest. It's risky. You can lose all your money. I'm like, oh, my God, this is crazy. Who the hell is going to give me money? I just paid this guy $30,000. Nobody's going to give me any money. So that was another challenge. Now you have the document. Now you have a lot of different companies that you have to be careful of who will promise you it's a one-stop shop. We'll set up your PPM and we'll help you raise the capital. And some of the companies out there are legit, but you really want an SEC attorney to set it up for you, go over legalities and let you know, because these companies are not law firms that can protect you or whatever. And most of the time they're setting it up for you so they can get a piece of the action on the capital they raise for you, similar to like a broker dealer. And you really lose in that situation. So I'm glad I rent the attorney route. And I learned so much organically from the attorney on what not to do, what to do, what's a credit investor, what's a non-accredited investor, what you can do if you're raising capital. Most people stand up in front of the room. If they're not set up for accredited investors, they're not allowed to do general solicitation. And there's so many things that you learn organically. Right. So to me, it was like I paid $30,000 for an education on how to become a bank. So it was all worth it. And the next 2 years was really tough because now that you have this private placement, all right, you have the documents to raise capital legally, but now you got to figure out where's your avatar. Like, who are you going to market to? Who are you going to promote this to? And the first time I set up was for non-accredited, so I couldn't just blast out on raising capital. It was with people who I had a pre-existing relationship with. I had to go
back
to those investors that went through the 08 thing with me and say, hey, guys, I paid you all back. It's been a few years. The market is starting to change. Here's a new opportunity I'm in. I'm doing notes. I invested $100,000 of my own capital. Here are the case studies of me making X amount of returns. What do you want to do? And people slowly, $25,000, $50,000, $20,000. It took a long time to raise $2 million.
Yeah, especially if you're doing it in small tranches like that of 25 and 50 grand, right?
Yeah, because it's crazy.
My experience is it's so much easier to raise capital from 1, 2, 3 or a handful of investors and to raise whatever you need versus having 50, 100 investors at 25, 50 grand a pop and you're trying to raise millions of dollars. I mean, it's so much more work.
Yeah, that part, when you do it like that, is you're managing people instead of capital.
Correct.
Right. And that's not what you want to do. But I had to learn. It was my first fund. And again, I had no track record of raising capital in a fund. This fund, the first NNG fund I set up in 2013, there was no existing track record. This was the first one. So when you would meet high-level investors, you go, yeah, I have a PPM. I have a fund. Okay, what's your historical returns? What have you done? Send me, what did you do? I'm like, oh, this is only 6 months. Well, we'll wait. We'll see how you do. And at the time, the term was a three-year term that I had the fund. So I was like, oh, man. So I spent this money. I can't market. I can only go back to people who I had pre-existing relationship with. So it took me really 2 years to kind of raise $2 million, which is a joke, right? So,
well, Fuquan, let me ask you this, man. Let me kind of just, because I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of somebody listening to this. And I've heard you use the word and the phrase pre-existing relationship a couple times, and that's key, right? So talk about what determines whether you have a pre-existing relationship with someone or not. So if you have an email list, for example, or you have a social media following, does that qualify as a pre-existing relationship, or is it someone that you've done business with? I mean, elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, so it's kind of foggy when it comes to that. I would say definitely black and white is somebody you've done business with in the past. So if you have a Facebook group or you have a mail list, you would have to show so much information on when the person entered the mail list. Was there any engagement outside of them just clicking on your email? Did you have lunch with them? Did you educate them? This is so much foggy area when you get to that. So me, I just went the route with people who had a pre-existing relationship with, people who invested in deals that I had already, people who may have partnered with me on deals when I was doing 50-50 joint ventures, just a multitude of that type of avatar that I was going after, because I didn't want to, because my SEC attorney was scaring the crap out of me. Like, if you do this, you can get banned. You can do this and that. So I didn't want to really do anything like that. When I went to the RIAs, I couldn't really say I'm raising capital. I had to develop a relationship with a person, educate them on what I was doing, take them out to lunch, and just give them information, put them on my mail list, feed them information on what we're doing organically as the company is growing, just keeping them updated until they approach me and go, hey, I've been on your mail list for a year or so. I know we went out to lunch for a few times. I've been to a few of your presentations. I'm interested in doing business with you.
Yeah.
So that's a pre-existing relationship from people who got to know me from going out, from speaking engagements or whatever. They was on my mailing list. We may have lunch a few times or spoke a few times. Now they came after me and said, I want to do business with you. So that's how I organically started to build the first fund. And once that money was raised and we made the returns and paid everybody back, now fund two was easier because I had the cookie cutter. So it wasn't 30 grand. It was like 12 grand to set up the next fund.
Yeah.
And then I had a historical return.
Which is big. Yeah. It's so much easier to raise that capital when you already have a track record behind you and you have more relationships, more people you've worked with. And, you know, one of the things I've learned about capital is that the elephant in the room is that when you're working with a new private lender, somebody that you're going to take capital from, they're more interested, oftentimes, my experience, to make sure that they're going to get a return on their money. Return of their money instead of a return on their money, right? So you got to address things like, hey, what happens if things go south? I'd love to hear you talk about the presentation piece and what the conversation looks like when you're raising capital from somebody that you have an existing relationship with, or maybe someone you don't, but you've never really worked with, right? Maybe somebody that's been on your email list and you've communicated, maybe you've had lunch, but you've actually never taken a dollar from them. What does a presentation look like? How do you put them at ease? And talk about that, because I think that's something that people listening to this that don't have a desire to start a fund, but do understand and see the importance of raising private capital. I'd love to hear you talk about how that conversation goes with a potential private lender.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's even if you're doing a real estate deal, right? So a fund for me was just a way for me to raise capital in one vehicle where I can execute when I want. The challenges I was having when I was doing a one-off private investor was one guy would say, hey, I have 100,000. One guy would say, I have 50,000. And back then, I was purchasing a property. I would have to put two people together. And then one guy during the closing would go, well, I changed my mind. So now you got to scramble and look for other investors. So for me to create a fund, it was easier to raise money, pool all the investments together, and pretty much execute on whatever my strategy or plan was. Right. But if you're doing a one-off deal, the communication with the investor is really similar because they want to know, when am I getting paid? When do I get my return on my principal that I'm investing back? And how am I secured, right? So basically, the discussion is whether you're doing monthly payments, quarterly payments, or you're doing one payment at the end, whatever, if you're deferring interest, whatever way you structure your note, you want to review that with them. And the mortgage or deed of trust, if you're in a deed of trust state, is how you're securing them, right? So if you get hit by Amazon bus, then they can come in and take over the project and move forward from there. Most of the investors don't want to do that. So what they're going to make sure is that the amount of capital they have in is lower than the value of the property. Most of them will go maybe 50% loan to value, 65% loan to value, whatever their comfort zone is, right? That means the amount of capital that they're going to lend you into the value of the property. So if something happened to you, they can just put it on the market, sell it right away, and at least get their capital back, maybe make some profit. Uh-huh. So you're showing them how they secure it. You're showing them if you need renovation money, whether you're putting up the money or they're putting up the money, how many construction drawers you're going to have, and you're going to outline exactly in detail what you're going to do in those drawers during those periods. And then you're going to let them know, today's age, I can send you videos on it to show you each phase so we have transparency and communication. So you talk to them about when are they going to get paid, when are they going to get their return of capital back. That's based on a return of the note, the term of the note, how they're secured, and you're giving transparency on where the money is going and the renovation of the property and the timeline. That's really the conversation. As far as documents, there's a variety of different documents that can protect the investor. Of course, there's a note mortgage, which is number one. You can do, I've seen deals where people do where they assign a rent, assignment of rent. So for example, if you default and don't pay the investor while they're trying to foreclose on you, they can, they have the assignment of rents file, which they can get a court order to take over rent. If you have tenants there, because you have some people who borrow money on properties that have rent to income and then they default and then they want to keep collecting a rent and don't pay the investor. So that gives the investor right to put a court order and get the assignment of rents over to them while they're foreclosed and they can collect the rent.
What about PG, personal guarantees?
Yep, you can actually have that in there, personal guarantor. Sometimes that's in the note language as well. And that protects the investor. And one that a lot of people don't know about, and I give you guys a jewel. So New Jersey is a judicial state where it takes forever to foreclose, right? And you have a lot of out-of-state investors from California, Texas, where it's non-judicial, where you can foreclose fast, who sometimes don't like to lend in the state of New Jersey. So a workaround that I found to give them more comfort as the investor, I would say, look, I'm going to set up an LLC, right? And you guys want to check with your attorney to make sure this is legit in your state, but I've done this. Set up an LLC, and we're going to be members of the LLC joint. 50-50, the operating agreement said we 50-50, even though I'm just paying you an interest, the operating agreement, or 51-49, whatever it is, right? So instead, if I default, you have, number one, you have security in the note and mortgage, so you can foreclose. But if you want to accelerate your ownership of the property, there can be, you have 51%, so there could be language in the operating agreement that you take over the LLC if I default.
Awesome.
Right? So you don't even have to go through foreclosure. You just take over the LLC and then you can continue that project under that same LLC. So
That is a jewel, man. That's solid.
Yeah. So you don't have to go through the foreclosure. It's just, okay, you defaulted. This LLC is the name of the property, 123 Main Street LLC. The offices are me and you. You're 51%. I'm 49%. Here is the operating agreement on what my responsibilities are and what I must do. If I default on that and don't have a remedy in X amount of time, whatever agreement you guys want to put together, you have full control over the LLC. I get nothing. You take full control. And they like that.
Yeah. So, it gives them more comfort and peace of mind. Yeah. I mean, and you're betting on yourself. You're putting your money where your mouth is, so to speak.
Yeah. I have nothing to lose, and everything to gain. So for the investor, that's really important piece. You could do a lot of different things. I heard people do deed and escrow, a whole bunch of different stuff. It just depends on what's legit in your state. And that's really how you make an investor comfortable, right? So if I get hit by Amazon bus, what's your backside protection? And once you lay that out, it becomes easier for them to do business with you.
Yeah, no doubt. And something I want to underscore, Fuquan, that you kind of said towards the beginning of our podcast here is you said you were explaining your story back in, I think, 2011, 12, 13. And you said something, you said, I wanted to make my investors whole. And that's so important that, like, when I work with somebody, I want to know that if it went sideways and the deal went south, that they would pick up a 9-to-5 at McDonald's just to make me whole. And I don't mean literally, but you get what I'm saying, right? Like, so you always want to make sure that your investors are protected, because at the end of the day, you need to do right by them. And it's your name and it's your reputation. It's your word on the line. So never, ever, ever burn an investor. Always do what you say you're going to do. That sounds obvious, but you'd be surprised. So as I kind of share that, I want to lead up to, as we start to wind down the show here, what are some of the biggest mistakes that either you have made or that you've seen other investors make when it comes to raising private capital and working with private lenders?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that for me, the mistakes that I made earlier on when I first created my fund was not really having a great marketing campaign. So let me talk about that a bit. After my first fund was done, I wanted to transition over to raising capital from accredited investors, which I thought was another tough challenge because I had no accredited investors in my network, right? And I thought it would be, okay, how do I get in a room full of accredited investors? I would say the biggest mistake that I made was, you know how they have these mailing lists where you can send mail out and all this other stuff. You watch all this stuff and then you have these guys reach out to you, because once you open a fund, you get on the radar of different marketing companies. Hey, we got leads to sell you. we can give you leads for people who's worth $2 million, $10 million, whatever. So you think, okay, if I get these leads and I do a mail campaign, I start sending postcards and offer steak dinners and do all of that stuff. You know, this stuff can fall because these are like doctors, lawyers, judges, all these high net worth people. And if your marketing is really not on point, a lot of that stuff can get you in trouble, even if you set up right. So for me, I think the biggest mistake was really trying to go that route. I didn't get into any trouble, but what happened was when I started to market to these people, people were like, because you had the information. And when you're sending postcards to the house, and these are people who live in mansions and everything else, and they get in a postcard and like, who is this guy? Like, you know what I mean? They're used to like the stock market, and I'm pushing alternative assets, trying to educate them, bombarding them with emails, sending postcards to their house. That was like not the way you want to market. Like if you're generating leads to do deals and flip houses to homeowners that are in distress, okay, I get that. But I try to use that same tactic on raising private capital, and just the backlash that I got from the people that were like high network people writing me letters, emailing me back, removing me from your list, calling them off. It was just crazy. I was like, wow, this is the wrong way to go. So I stopped that immediately. And what I truly learned was the real way to raise money is going, pressing the flesh, meeting people, building relationships with people. It takes time.
Yeah.
It takes a year or two to establish a relationship with somebody, let them see what you're doing, transparency, and then becoming familiar with who you are, what you do.
Right.
And then eventually they will invest with you on their time when they are ready. Right.
Right.
So you can't have blast text messages, calling people. Like, that's the wrong way to go.
Yeah. And that's the kind of stuff that can really like land you in hot water. That's what you want to avoid.
Even if you're set up right, it's still going to cost you money and legal to get out of that mess.
Correct. And that's why masterminds, whether it's Ascend or whether it's other masterminds, it's so important to dig your well before you're thirsty. Again, build relationships with people, with the right people, because you just never know. And you want to, as a side note, you want to build relationships not with the thought in the back of your mind that you're looking to extract from the relationship, but the opposite. You want to contribute to the relationship, and everything you ever want will always come around. You always want to contribute, not extract.
Absolutely. Now, something you said was very important. It brought me back to when I would go out, when I had my fun, right? I would go out with the mindset that I'm going to this event to raise capital. And that's the wrong thing to do, because I never raised capital when I went to these events. When I started to shift my mindset, I understood the business. I was like, okay, you're not going to raise money when you meet somebody right at the event. You're not going to go and say, hey, my name is Papan, I raise capital. I'm going to go, here's a check for $100,000. That's never going to happen, right? So people got to know, like, and trust you. So I started to shift my mindset and say, okay, I'm going to go to this event and try to build a relationship with one or two people where I can learn what they do, listen to them, and see how I can add value. And then if they just happen to ask me what I do, now I got my elevator pitch.
Yeah.
Right. And my takeaway would be, okay, I do this, I do that, but only the people who qualify. And they go, oh, well, what did it take to qualify? Then, well, let's do lunch. Let's talk about it, so on and so forth. Or once I build a relationship with them, I won't even discuss that I'm raising capital. After I build a relationship with them and even out to lunch a few times, I'll start, hey, what you think about this deal? If I buy it for this and I sell it for that, I could potentially make this. And these are other people who invest in real estate also. Mm-hmm. So they understand the business. They go, oh, that's a great return. How can I be involved? So it was a different way that I went about educating people, showing transparency, and in return, people wanted to do business with me. So I was no longer hunting. I was fishing.
Yeah.
As they say.
Hugely valuable, man. Hugely valuable. And I'm really glad that you kind of ended the show on that note, because it's all this is, man, is mindset and relationships. It's easy to learn the X's and O's, and that's where you can plug into podcasts like this. And on that note, Fuquan, I'm going to throw it up here, but guys, I want to encourage you to connect with Fuquan. Not only is he a great guy, but obviously he's got a wealth of knowledge. And I really just value relationships with people that are very honest and transparent. And that's what I've known Fuquan to be. So nngcapitalfund.com. And you can also connect with him on Instagram, Facebook. It's all the same. Fuquan Bilal.
Yeah, Fuquan Bilal. Yep.
Okay. Okay, beautiful, man. Well, dude, any kind of parting words here? Again, I'm glad that you hopped on the podcast here, man. I think raising capital, private lending, this is always one of those like topics and areas that people just want to hear different experiences and different approaches on. And I don't know that I've ever had somebody who has created their own and launched their own funds. So you kind of came at it from a little bit of a different angle, but I think we touched on both sides. that mixed in with some of the challenges and adversity of your past, I think is going to make this just a really powerful show for a lot of people out there. I appreciate the vulnerability and transparency.
Awesome, man. Yeah, the one last parting word I would say is, and this go for anyone, you want to become a warrior. And to me, a warrior is one who conquer oneself. So you're always on that. It's a life journey to do that. So yeah, those are my parting words. You know,
I love it, man. I love it. Well, my man, you know, I'm always here for you if you need anything. And my friends, again, this show does not exist without you subscribing and sharing and being a part of it. My goal and Fuquan's goal, our aim is to always just impact and try to contribute. Again, this is a relationship, whether you know it or not. I know you're listening to me, you're listening to us. And so if there's ever anything that I can do for you, please reach out. Don't hesitate. Outside of that, I look forward to connecting with you on the next show. Fuquan, my man, keep doing your thing. Appreciate you. Thank you for opening up.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be in contact.
Absolutely.
So that's a wrap on episode 538. And I want to just go ahead and introduce you to a resource and a training that can be really, really valuable for you. You know, we just finished having a great conversation with Fuquan about raising private capital, about working with private lenders. And I want to take it a step further. If you're interested in earning income, lending other people's money, if you want to learn how to not just work with private lenders and get the ins and outs of just specifically how to structure these deals, but if you're interested in even being a private lender and having access to all the funding that you might ever need, I want to introduce you to this training that my good friend Lee put together. If you go to flipempire.com/capital. flipempire.com/capital. It's a very easy to consume, easy training that not only walks you through the private lending business, not just being a private lender, working with private lenders, and also at the same time, showing you how you can earn income from other people's money, while at the same time giving you access to all the capital that you need for your own deals. flipempire.com/capital. And if you have any questions and you can, if you want to lean on me as you go through that training, let me know. And I'm happy to extend myself as an additional resource. So once again, flipempire.com/capital. Talk to you soon and look forward to connecting with you on the next one. All right, my friend, I hope you enjoyed that Flip Empire episode and got a lot of value out of it. Make sure to check the show notes page for any resources that were mentioned. And speaking of resources, honestly, I don't think I've done the best job of sharing with you my top curated, highly recommended tools and resources that I use in my business or have used in my business. In some cases, these are affiliate relationships with people that I highly trust and respect. And I know these tools and resources can help you and your business go to the next level. And as an ethical bribe, if you decide to try out one of these resources using my link, I will go ahead and send you an unadvertised bonus. I'll send you something of high value. All you got to do is shoot me an email, alex@flipempire.com. Go ahead and let me know that you tried out this resource, and however I can help you getting started with that, chances are that I know it very, very well and currently use it or have used it. So make sure to check that out, flipempire.com/resources. And if I can be of help or service to you in any way, just shoot me an email, alex@flipempire.com, and I will do anything I can for you. Have an amazing day, and I'll catch you on the next show.